Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is the author of an important and lovely book, Early Spring, An Ecologist and Her Children Wake to a Warming World. Amy Seidel writes in the preface to the book, "While I've spent time in regions of the world where global warming is more rapidly affecting ecosystems, I want to emphasize the changes I see in my landscape close to my home, in my garden, in local woods and ponds. It's in this everyday context that I notice the world entering flux. The timing of seasonal events, for instance, is shifting. Lilacs are blooming earlier. Gardens remain prolific well into the fall, and butterflies appear weeks earlier than previously recorded. But it's not only the natural landscapes that are shifting. In her rural community, cultural traditions tied to the season are no longer assured. Ice fishing derbies and winter carnivals are on again, off again. The start of maple sugaring rarely begins in the spring, in early March as it historically did. As I wake to these signs, I place each onto a growing list that challenges my sense of season, cycle, and time, and even my expectation of what is true." Amy is a practicing ecologist and activist, a mother of two girls, and writes about the state of life itself in this book, Early Spring. She has spent 20 years studying ecology, evolution, and butterflies across the North American continent and illuminates the historical significance and the everyday local impacts of global warming on the 21st century landscape in her book. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Amy. We've already had an email that came in long before we went on the air this morning, so we'll be getting to emails as well. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Amy. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, Kathleen, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. Tell me about where you live.
I live in Vermont, actually, in northern New England, a little town called Huntington, actually, which lies just south of Burlington and pretty close to the Green Mountains, which run along the backbone of the state of Vermont.
And tell me about your neighbors. What do people do for a living there?
Yeah, you know, a variety of things. It's a rural town, about 2,000 people, so many people commute to Montpelier or Burlington, local towns, to work. But many people stay in town and are farmers. We have a dairy in town and several other farms that are active, vegetable production and beef production. My neighbors do everything from homesteading. My closest neighbor actually lives and tries to run her lifestyle and her livelihood on what she can grow and make and sell and trade. The neighbor on the other side is an engineer, works at the IBM plant about 20 miles away, but also is very interested in how a lifestyle can be more tightly coupled with the conditions, the environmental conditions at hand, and can actually be promoting of life and not extinguishing.
And many of your neighbors, in addition to you, of course, have kept pretty careful notice of what's happening to trees and wildlife and all of that, simply because of where you live. They've tracked some of the changes, some of their observations, for years.
That's right. I have one neighbor who lives just about a mile away. He's actually a professor of physiology at the University of Vermont. But his great love is to note the arrival of birds on the pond where we all skate and boat and canoe. We can't swim in it because the leeches are so thick. But for years, 30 years now, he has chronicled and recorded both the weather and these sightings, these natural history observations. And he is like many others, actually, in the country. These records are so important to climate scientists and ecologists because they are the longest record we have of how these changes have affected natural communities over the last 3, 4, sometimes 5 decades. People, you know, have been recording as long as Thoreau was around, right? In the 1800s, Thoreau was recording the phenology of spring in Walden, at Walden Pond and in Concord. And John Muir did, too. Well, that's good history for us to use, but these 20th century records that actually span the time of warming, the greatest warming has occurred since 1970, are so important because they are the record of change that we otherwise wouldn't have.
You talk about going swimming in that pond. If it didn't have leeches,
yes,
you might be able to go swimming instead of ice skating in December, right?
That's right. Well, that's just as you said in your preamble to our conversation. We're noticing sometimes such radical changes, not only the nuanced changes and something that might be more subtle, like when a particular flower is occurring on the landscape. But 2 years ago, we had a very warm winter, one of the warmest in this decade of warmest winters on record, and we were canoeing at Christmas and not ice skating. And it was quite a distinct change. Certainly, we didn't canoe the next winter, so it was cold again. But the idea that it represented what the future winter landscape might look like, and may well, very well, because we're seeing a warming trend and we will through the next century, was strong enough for us to note, wow, what radical change in conditions we're up against.
Right. Your book, somebody has said this about your book, which is very profound, that it has the potential to be immensely influential, a real turning point in the popular appreciation of climate change impacts among laypersons and scientists alike.
Yes.
What do you think about that?
Well, I really appreciate that comment. And I think, you know, as a scientist, I spent many years thinking the effect of climate change on ecosystems, right? But it wasn't until I actually had children and was thinking about what the future looked like, what life itself was going to be tested by because of these conditions, that I felt really compelled to sit down and think about climate change historically, culturally, and ecologically. And I think that is the difference about my book, Early Spring, is that I'm not only thinking about it from a scientific perspective, what's happening continentally, what's happening in terms of the movement of species on the landscape, that's very important. But how does that affect our own sense of time, our own expectation of what is true, what seasonality means, and how we can be optimistic about the future given this kind of flux? I think it really has quite profound psychological implications for us, as well as scientific and ecological ones.
So what do you teach your daughters? Can they learn to love something that may not be around when they're 60 years old?
Well, I think you can. I mean, I think that obviously they're right now unencumbered by the notion of crisis. They accept the fact that spring is here, you know, 2 weeks into 3 weeks earlier than it was when people my age were growing up in Vermont. So they are certainly living in an environment that's different from a person who's been in that landscape for 40 or 50 years. But I do try to teach my children about life itself, about the need for us, and I'm saying this obviously with the day after Earth Day, but certainly in the swell of thinking about the Earth and our stewardship, that we all have a role to play in stewarding this planet and in stewarding the landscapes where we live. And this has great potential for us as human beings to not only enjoy those landscapes, but feel responsible and an obligation to their continuation. You know, this is such a historic time for human civilization. I believe that because we are aware just what the power of change we can put into place. But with that comes a kind of responsibility, a collective responsibility, and a moral one, I think, ultimately, to live in a world and live in a way that is promoting of life itself, the very essence of our survival, but also because non-human beings have value and worth and a place here too, obviously.
Right. I know that you've done studies of the poles of Arctic ice, et cetera. It seems as though most of the news that we've concentrated on and most of the national news has looked at the poles and look at barrier reef, you know, reefs, bridges disappearing, ice bridges,
yes.
and looked at the amount of ice cover and how that's diminishing. Is there a strong scientific link now between global, and that's been said to be because of global warming in large measure, is there the same kind of scientific research that looks at the everyday things that you've looked at, you know, the early arrival of spring, the lack of winter, the warm winters, the maple sugar farmers, an earlier maple sugaring season, the kinds of species that maybe there or may not be there as a result of global warming or not? Have we not made that link yet?
Yes, you know, it's a great question. And one, the first thing to note is that this is a tremendously complex system. You know, trying to figure out, one, the complexity of the climate itself is just far beyond our capacity, and certainly testing our capacity to model and to predict the future. That said, we still have very good data coming out, more general and more gross than we will have in time, where we'll get actually more specific results, i.e., what exactly is the prediction of a particular region, right, over time with climate change. We're not there quite yet, but we're getting there. That said, what we have is not causal relationship, but correlation relationship. So rather than saying this factor, this particular temperature is driving this response in nature, what we can say is that they are very closely linked, statistically and otherwise. So if we look at temperature data over the last century, what we see is that temperature is very closely related to when birds, particular species of birds, migrate. Or temperature is very closely related and triggers the flowering in lilacs, or the arrival of certain butterflies from their overwintering, you know, whether they're overwintering as caterpillars or as adults. So what we have in non-Arctic zones is this tight relationship between temperature oftentimes, but sometimes it's actually precipitation or some other aspect of weather that is tied to climate change that is affecting natural response. So again, the issue is that the complexity of climate science will keep us from actually showing causal relationships, i.e., this factor is the result or this response is the result of this particular factor, but instead what we have is the relationship between particular factors like temperature and precipitation with responses on the ground. I hope that that's clear. But, you know, if we just take the example of, say, lung cancer, right, and smoking, for a long time we knew that people who smoked got cancer and got lung cancer, but it wasn't until we could actually prove in a court of law that this particular gene was affected by, you know, nicotine or by tar, that we had the causal relationship, even though we knew that this was very tightly related. We just didn't know causally why. That's sort of where we are with climate change and the response of natural communities.
And certainly we're noticing this in Vermont, in Milwaukee, all over the country, that there seems to be, and tell me what scientists are saying about this, these real extremes, either drought or heavy, heavy rainfalls, flooding like I've never seen before in my life, or huge snowfalls, and then followed by maybe 70 degrees or something, just very erratic weather patterns.
That's exactly right, Kathleen, and that is the prediction. You know, the prediction is that our weather, which is already has some variability, will become much more variable. So even though we have a signal, the signal of increasing temperature, we have a lot of noise around that signal over time, and that is the expectation. Partly that's because more temperature, more heat in the atmosphere exacerbates things like the hydrologic cycle, which is the movement of water from our rivers and streams and oceans into the atmosphere. And that energy creates more storm activity. So we expect that. We expect more storm activity, more extreme weather, but also this linear trend right now of higher temperatures through that noise. And that's what we're seeing. I mean, in the book I talk about the fact that in the last even 2 or 3 years we had, you know, the greatest, most precipitation in the month of May, the most precipitation in the month of October, the warmest December on record. And if you would go to any state in the country, you'll find that these historic weather records are being broken. And that is quite in keeping with what the climate modelers are saying about the future. Much more extreme weather, more variable weather, and overall warmer weather.
And tell me about the lilacs. Wasn't there a mass planting of lilacs somewhere? And so we can look at them and say with some authority that they're blooming much earlier than they used to?
That's right, and it's a really great story because it's like those record keepers. They're keeping record not because they were thinking about climate change, but because they loved looking at birds. Well, 40 years ago, the USDA planted a species of lilac red Rothamagensis is the variety, the cultivar, in 70 locations around the Northeast. And they did that because they knew that lilac was often a good proxy, a good early indicator of the arrival of spring, whether it was a first sighting of bumblebees or when the hay would first be cut or other kinds of agricultural activities that would happen after this indicator was found. So they wanted to track, and they wanted to give farmers more information about what they could expect of the spring, and they used lilac flowering as that proxy measurement. So they planted lilacs across the Northeast, and what's very interesting is they planted cuttings from the same big clone of a plant. So they're genetically identical. So there is no way that the response to flowering could be different because of genetics. The genetics are the same. So the response is really based on the environment. And what they found was that lilacs, since 1965, are now blooming between 2 and 4 days earlier per decade. So over the last 4 decades, they're blooming between 8 and 16 days earlier, depending on location. And that is very tightly connected with temperature, meaning temperature explains that result better than any other factor that they could consider.
Amy Seidel is our guest this hour. Her book, Early Spring, An Ecologist and Her Children Wake to a Warming World. Amy is an ecologist and environmental scientist who has taught at Middlebury College and the University of Vermont. She works as an advocate for clean energy and sustainable agriculture, and she has done work really all over the world on the effects of global climate rising. This particular book is just, it's a beautiful book. She's a heck of a writer, and it looks at what's happening in her rural community in Vermont and the very keen and poetic observations of what changes are taking place. And add this to being a mom with a couple daughters and going through walks in the woods and paying very careful attention to everything that's around. So let's go to your phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number. If you'd like to send us an email, that is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Amy Seidel, our guest. We go to your phone calls, starting with Kurt from Springbrook. Hi, Kurt.
Hi. Yeah, I live in northwestern Wisconsin, and the way I see it is that our civilization, our culture, has been here about 200 years. And before that, the Ojibwa lived here for approximately, according to them, about 10,000 years. And they seemed to live all right. I don't think they were facing what we're facing environmentally. So I guess my first question is what do the indigenous of our North America have to teach us? I mean, what do the elders have to show us about how we can live our lives differently? And secondly, I'm starting to see it as the problem with our social organization. The way I see it is that we've lived either in civilization or we've lived tribally. And the way I see it is tribalism is a gift of natural selection to human beings, and we're not recognizing that. And I think if we still live tribally, our future wouldn't be measured in decades. I think it'd be measured in thousands or tens of thousands of years. And that's all I got to say.
Thank you, Kurt.
Wow, Kurt, that lots of great points there. I want to talk about that first point about Ojibwe, you say, have lived in upper Wisconsin. And in my part of the woods, it's the Abnaki, who are the Native Americans there. You know, of course, there was a very different time when we had early Americans in this country, Native Americans, and even the Paleo Indians. I was looking at some data recently that shows that 20,000 years ago there were Paleo Indians here in Colorado, where I'm talking to you from today. So a tremendous longevity, you know, tens of thousands of years versus the more recent colonial history of European ancestors in North America. That said, there's some very interesting new anthropological data in a book by Charles Mann called 1491, which shows just how much engineering Native Americans did on the landscape. And so although we might have some ideal notion that those populations weren't as manipulative of the environment as we are now, there's growing evidence to say that they were, that they really changed soils, that they rerouted rivers, that they grew plants that came in from Mesoamerica and South America into North America, too. What's distinctly different, of course, is that their populations were far, far lower than ours. And so their impact, not nearly what the impact of the Industrial Revolution and increasing population, increasing consumption of the last 100 years. You know, your point about tribal communities, I think, is very interesting, and there is some very interesting evolutionary data. Paul Ehrlich and Ann Ehrlich write about this in their own books, about there's a sort of an evolutionary capacity for us to do best in smaller bands, and that we don't do as well in larger populations, and that if you actually look at our social structure, we usually, as individuals now, relate to the kind of size of band that evolutionarily we use to relate to, you know, a couple thousand years ago. But I think that we could actually apply some of those that thinking to books like Bill McKibben's most recent book on deep economy and others who are looking at, you know, the role of community right now in sustainable civilization, let's just say. How does it, you know, how can we actually live in smaller, at a smaller scale, more regional scale, with local economies, and where we actually see the effect of our purchases, our consumption, and our own obligation to those economies through smaller communities. So that, I think that that's an interesting point. The last point you made was about time and about, you know, whether or not if our focus was more tribal or more community based, then our sense of time and our obligation perhaps to the future would be stronger than it is now. And I that's a very fascinating concept, because I struggle sometimes with relating the oncoming issues of climate change, you know, what this century looks like, this century of warming that's unfolding, because I'm concerned that when I say the word century or 100 years, people begin to blank and say, oh, I can't do anything about that. That's too long a time frame for me to wrap my head around. And so I am very interested in coming up with language and thinking about a way to inspire and compel the American public to think about the future at 100-year intervals or even greater intervals, so that this notion of stewardship and this notion of us being, you know, the ones who can promote life for the future indefinitely can be realized. So I struggle with that, and I really think about your notion of communal tribal living being a way into that sense of future and our responsibility.
Oh, what an interesting answer.
Yeah.
Thank you, Kurt, very much for the call. Let's go to an email. It's kind of a couple-part question from Patricia in Milwaukee. Would the range of where kudzu grows be an indication of warming? Has its range changed much since 1980? Why in the U.S. do we not hear mention of global climate change when weather catastrophes are a continuing occurrence and global climate change is impacting our lives tragically? I believe there would be a groundswell of support for addressing the urgency if scientists and government officials and anybody else would just say the words.
Yeah. A great set of questions. You know, I don't know about kudzu specifically, but certainly people are thinking a lot about how invasive species and the invasibility of natural communities how it will change with climate change. You know, what we know about species like kudzu and other weedy non-natives is that they do very well in a variety of settings in a variety of environmental conditions. And so as those conditions, like temperature for kudzu, which is a more southern species, can enjoy, let's say, and can deal with the colder winters, which are now less cold, we will certainly see the expansion, like other southern species, into the north. In fact, one of the predominant climate models for North America is a model called the Hadley model, and it predicts Burlington, Vermont, which is my part of the woods, to be like Richmond, Virginia
in terms of
climate by the end of the century. And so if just to take that as an example and then just for anybody listening to this call, think about a similar kind of, you know, latitudinal change. That's what we'll see, and we'll certainly see species moving with it. The other point about the groundswell in the American public, this is, you know, something I'm very, very much tracking and certainly in the business of promoting right now, i.e. American public's hold on these issues, and they're confronting them and they're prioritizing them. You know, what we found, there was a great poll done by Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Science in October, right before the election, and what they showed was that the American public is no longer skeptical about climate. They get the science. They believe it. The doubt is gone. However, they see it as geographically and psychologically distant, and that it's unfolding slowly. And so those are the areas where we really need to work as communicators about the science and about the cultural effect, i.e. that it's happening right here in our backyards, not only in the Arctic or in the Pacific or the coral reefs, as you mentioned, but right here in our gardens, in our forests, in the way our seasons unfold. And not only that, it's affecting our sense of time. You know, a friend of mine talks about the fact that her child is born in the summer, and they always have the first peaches at this birthday. But because peaches are coming earlier to the market because they're flowering earlier and setting fruit earlier, that doesn't correspond any longer. Now, that seems like a small bit of thing, but if you can imagine, we've only changed the temperature by 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit. We'll see 4-degree difference by the end of the century. Well, that's magnitudes different than now, and that will certainly impact how we see the world.
Sure it will.
Yes, everything will change.
And is it psychologically distant for us because, in one sense, 100 years, when we live in this cycle that's every day there's some major thing going on, is that part of it? And is it also psychologically distant because it's something we don't want to take in? We're talking about some very significant changes that might be hard for us to absorb psychologically.
Yeah, I think you're right, Kathleen. I think that's good speculation. People are just getting into this literature and beginning to talk about it. Many talk about it from a sense of risk and risk analysis. People don't feel that they're at risk yet, or that they don't need to, there are other things that are pressing in their lives that take their attention and that have more risk associated with them, right? So partly what we need to do is talk about the risk and actually relate the flooding that we saw in Bismarck, North Dakota, or the hurricane season coming earlier and in some parts of the world being year-round now to climate change. You know, there's a general sense, and this is a point I always like to make. Science is pretty conservative, you know, as a rule. If I'm a scientist and I go out and I find a result, unless I'm 95% certain of that result, I'm not likely to publish that result, right? I have to be really, really certain. And that lends a conservatism to science. But we have a whole body of anecdote that's building. All of these relationships, all of these changes that are building, and they're certainly related to temperature. That is enough. That's significant enough for meteorologists to begin to say, well, this is like the future that we should expect. And yet we don't hear them saying that. So I'm really promoting us, both in the scientific community and in the lay community, to say this body of anecdote is significant. You know, it is varied, it is diverse, it is mounting, and it's something we can trust as the signal of change in the future. And that, I think, would galvanize people who don't feel it lodged yet in their bodies, don't feel it happening in their lives. It would begin to change that conversation for them.
Let's go to Tom from Minnetonka, Minnesota. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
My question is, I do believe there's some global warming going on here. But the problem why the public doesn't believe that it's of essence is, like, you haven't quantified it. Like, what's the standard deviation of the weather changing from year to year, and what's the time period you guys have observed this over? Is it just 100 years? Is it 200 years? You know, is it 1,000 years? I mean, how are we looking at this data? And you know, if you put things in standard deviations, you know, are we going back and forth? And are we just in right now a trend that is going warmer, which in 20 years could start going the other way.
Yeah, Tom, I appreciate that. And you know, I say in the book, actually, that, you know, I'm a, as a scientist, I am a skeptical person. You know, I analyze data, and I look at it very closely, and I look at the kind of statistical analysis you're referring to. You know, what are the standard errors and the standard deviation? How well was this experiment carried out, for instance? And I am certainly convinced. You know, I mean, this is a huge science. My science is more biological, and there's a lot of atmospheric and physical science, lots of oceanography in this work too. But I trust, you know, the fact that every couple of years, 2,000 or more scientists and thousands of scientific papers are gone over by this group called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, and they've now published 4 reports over the last decade and a half, looking at the science and comparing, as you suggest, to natural variations in climate, to the kind of astronomical changes that might result in warming or cooling trends, as we've seen in the Earth's past during the glacial and interglacial times, for instance, and repeatedly and now decisively in the most recent report have very, very strong certainty that this is an anthropogenic effect, that this is due to fossil fuel burning, it's due to our transformation of landscapes, especially forested ones, that not only combust but then are no longer regions that can take up carbon. And so there really is a unified a consensus around the fact that this is anthropogenic and not strictly variability. Now, sure, we still have those natural variations at play. You know, what's happening in terms of the Earth's precision, which is how it wobbles on its axis, and other kinds of astronomical effects. But, you know, what we know, what we can say, again, almost definitively, and by truly a consensus of the scientists in the world who study this work and analyze other people's science, is that the driver of climate change now, at this point in time in the Earth's history, is human-caused. And this has not, you know, that conclusion has not been made lightly. It has been made, again, with about 15 years of study and concentrated discerning and probing look at the science. And I think everybody is very convinced.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for the call. Can you tell me just a little bit more about, because this has to be changing people's livelihoods in many ways, too. We talked about weather. We've seen reports this week that people who operate ski hills in places like Vermont and elsewhere in the Northeast just haven't had snow. They have to find another line of business, I guess. What's been happening with maple sugar farmers in your area?
Yeah. Well, you asked me about my neighbors early in the call, and on my road is about a mile and a half long, there are 3 maple sugar growers and probably, I don't know, probably 20 or 30 in my town of 2,000. So it is a vibrant industry, or I should say it has had great history and lots of people are in that business. Tapping maple sugar maple sugar trees is strongly related to temperature. So when you have freezing nights and above freezing days, the sap begins to flow and begins to move out from the trunk into the branches and ultimately out to the buds. And you can capture that by, as you know, tapping trees. Well, because spring is coming earlier, and we talked about lilacs as one of the ways we can note and we can actually track this early arrival of spring, we're also seeing the early arrival of sap movement in trees. Sometimes that happens as early as January. So where historically, and we know this because in Vermont, you know, Vermont was founded in 1770s, and probably after the Abenaki showed the colonists how to do it, we've been tapping trees probably from the early 1800s. Some people have kept records exactly when they have tapped every year, and families have, you know. And so we can see that it's happening earlier and earlier, and sometimes as early as January. Now, that's sort of like the flooding in Bismarck for us, you know, to see spring or this season of tapping coming 2 months earlier is just a phenomenal change. What happens, of course, is if it stays warm, then the trees, the sap doesn't run any longer, and it's a very short season, and people don't do very well. In fact, what we're seeing is that the Canadian tappers and the Canadian sugar makers are overall doing better than Vermont, because it stays colder. The season, that early arrival of spring, because it's more northern, happens a little bit later. So even though they're seeing an earlier spring, they're not seeing as shortened a season. But it is variable. Obviously, some years we're tapping in January, and other years we're tapping as we have done historically. But that's part of the variability we've talked about. You know, this isn't going to be just a straight line. Once we pass a particular date, then that's the way it is from here on. It's going to continue to be variable. And that's a hard thing for people to both track in their minds and say, is yes. climate change is responsible for it.
Let's go to Mark from Wauwatosa. Hi, Mark.
Hi there.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, I'm really excited by all this. Good topic today, and I understand the lilacs. I've got some out in my yard. I see them bloom earlier every year. And I listen to the radio. I listen to a lot of radio. I listen to the righties and the lefties, if you want to call it that. And I'm wondering, and you just Amy touched on something about aggregating language so we can get our arms around the fact that things are changing. Yet I hear people say, well, when I look out, you know, in my backyard and I see my yacht out in the ocean, I don't see any change. Yet I hear people call up and say, gee, there's like a 70-yard or 70-mile coastline off of Oregon that's dead because of oxygen depletion, for example. So I'm wondering, what percentage, have we been able to aggregate at this point, what percentage of global change we humans are causing versus the natural phenomenons of the Mount St. Helens of the world? Mm-hmm. And to add one more thing, I know that we've got some data now about the rainforests having gone through a drought and the reduction in carbon dioxide conversion. And I'm kind of going, and we're clipping those rainforests down at a pretty good rate to support our worldwide economic model, which is based on growth. And has anybody in the scientific community started to extrapolate out where the points of convergence are for all this?
Great set of questions. And I think that what I like so much about your question, or set of questions, is that you're starting to think systemically, and so am I, you know. All these points that you make, one, first, a psychological point that we have some populations, some individuals really seeing these changes, feeling like they own them, feeling like they can see them as directly related to climate change, and others still not seeing them for whatever reason. Maybe their particular landscape, maybe they live in an urban area and don't have as close a connection to those changes, you know, the way I do, for instance, in a backyard that is still very much a natural community. So that exists for sure. Even though I mentioned about the skepticism, there's still people who can see it more easily than others. In terms of this notion of systemic change, you know, my friend Sandra Steingraber, who's a wonderful writer and another ecologist, describes climate change to her children this way. You know, imagine that you're in a boat, and in that boat you're bailing because there's a hole in the boat, and you've got one oar, you've lost an oar, and you're trying to kind of get yourself back to that oar with one oar and you're bailing, and there's a giant wave that's about to hit. That wave is climate change, and the boat and the compromised position of the boat is where we are before it hits. So we're not, you know, climate change is one of multiple environmental issues, but environmental and economic issues, because obviously the repercussions of an Oregon coast being anoxic, i.e. no longer oxygenated, is problematic for fisheries, it's problematic for tourism, it's problematic for all kinds of sectors that have economic repercussions as well. So these are environmental and economic issues that we have found ourselves compromised in, by and large, because of our level of consumption, the human population, and I think, as you mentioned, this model of growth that is dominant in our society. And in our political economic system. Yes, go ahead, Kathleen.
Yes, thanks, Mark, so much. No, yeah. I was just going to move into something else. I noticed in the book that Rachel Carson begins each of your chapters with some wonderful quotes from some of her books. What role has she played in making us aware, and what role has she played in your life?
Yeah. She, you know, we were celebrating her 100th birthday when I was writing early.
Oh.
And so she was very present in my mind. She's been a hero of mine all my life, you know, as a scientist and as somebody who wanted to write lyrically about science. She is, you know, she's unparalleled. She's just phenomenal in her talent. The other thing about Carson was that she was writing Sense of Wonder, which is her book about children in nature, when she stopped that project to write Silent Spring. Now, it turns out from her letters, you can see she didn't actually want to stop that project. She didn't want to write Silent Spring. She tried hard to get other people to write it because she was already diagnosed with cancer, and she wanted to be in that world of children in nature. Well, that was a world that I was in when I was writing Early Spring. My children were 1 and 6 when I was writing this book and when I began it. And so being with them in nature was being in the sense of wonder, as Carson described it. And I was so inspired by her sense of that and including it in my own discovery of what it means to steward life itself in the context of climate change, that I decided that she would preface each chapter and I could invoke her inspiration and also her quality of communication around science in my own book. Obviously, the title, Early Spring, is our strongest phenological marker of climate change in North America, the arrival of spring, but it is also an homage to Carson's own work, and I certainly admit that.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Let's take more phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Amy Seidel, who also writes lyrically about early spring, and her book is lovely in addition to being extremely important. An ecologist and her children wake to a warming world. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to phone calls for Amy Seidel. Her book is Early Spring, An Ecologist and Her Children Wake to a Warming World. Val is next from Green Bay. Hi, Val.
Hello. This is a nice program. Thank you for having it. I read a book, I read it twice, I liked it so much, called The Long Summer by Brian Fagan, How Climate Changed Civilization. And he goes back to the Ice Age, you know, and kind of works up. And the interesting thing about it was, the main thing in the book, when you boiled it all down, was that when man could survive climate change before, because they were in small groups, things could change. They could change their food sources. They could even move if they wanted to. But the more man got into things like irrigation, grain growing, things like that, the more they were tied to those things. And then when climate changed, actual civilizations died out because they couldn't just move. They couldn't just go to another food source. It got harder and harder to do. And now look where we are. I mean, we're depending on trucking stuff across the United States and the oceans. So if we have major climate changes that affect food, the whole globe could really be in trouble.
Mm. Yeah, Val, I appreciate that. And I do know Brian Fagan's work, great anthropologist from the University of California. You know, I think that what's so interesting about your point is our ability to adapt. And as you mentioned in Brian's thesis, is that as smaller populations, we had more flexibility. You know, we could move on. We could grow different things. We were small enough. We had more flexibility. Now, of course, we have much, much larger economies and a much larger population and a whole human economic engine that is fueled by fossil energy. The big question for us then is, how will we adapt? And how will we adapt at a population of 9 billion people very, very quickly? You know, the notion of adaptation has not gotten a lot of traction in climate change discussion because people were concerned that if we start to talk about adaptation too soon, then the paramount nature of mitigation, i.e. bringing that carbon down, was going to lose out. So people like Al Gore and others just have not wanted to bring adaptation into the conversation. But now we realize that the next century, at least, is irreversible in terms of warming. You know, these compounds, these gases in the atmosphere are long-lived, and they're going to be there for the next century, and we're going to see a warming world consistently. So the question for us is, how do we adapt? Now, you know, Fagan and Jared Diamond, who wrote the book Collapse, might be saying, listen, we may not be able to because we are stuck in certain patterns of being. But my feeling is that adaptive capacity is ours to be done, and we can design a way to be adaptive to these changes. It's going to be very hard, and we're going to see lots and lots of suffering. But there is a way to design new infrastructure, new agriculture, new ways of being that will ultimately, I think, result in greater equity and greater flexibility to these changing conditions. Just as one example, and this is a small example, but the USDA is publishing the planting zone map, right, which shows which zone of plants you can grow depending where you live. And the last time they published that was 1990. Well, the whole country has changed in terms of zones. I've moved from 3 to 4, and parts of Vermont are already into 4.5.
Ooh.
So we're really planting different things. This year, I'm planting peaches. You know, I live at 1,100 feet in the Green Mountains, and I can plant peaches now. So that's a very different agricultural reality. Small, again, just one example. But stone fruits in Vermont are now a reality, and that hasn't been.
Thank you very much, Val, for the call. Joseph is our next caller from La Crosse. Hello, Joseph.
Good morning, ladies. First, let me preface my remarks by saying that I'm completely in agreement with the push for sustainability, and I really believe that we need to march in that direction. And I don't know if a return to tribalism is in the cards for us, but certainly we need to recognize the connectedness of each of us within that community. But that said, I would suggest a couple of things. First, I'm so pleased to hear you mention Rachel Carson, because as it turned out, her science was mostly wrong. And in her desire to rid the world of DDT, she rid the world of the one thing that was keeping almost 1 million children a year from dying of malaria. And now we find out that she was on the right track, certainly, and that, you know, maybe 100 parts per million, totally unnecessary. But 2 parts per million just kills insects and the things that were causing the malaria outbreak that exists in many parts of the world. And so my fear is, in the business world, we would say that the reaction might be called ready, fire, aim. And the problem is that we begin everything you've discussed today, I'm in line with, but you're talking about effects, and we haven't looked at the underlying causes. And you mentioned that there's an anthropogenic cause to it, but we don't really, on the basis of a continuum of climate over thousands of years, we don't really have the data to support that. And the IPCC, you know, you got to love them, but let's face it, it was not simply a group of clerics and the religious front that declared that Galileo was a heretic, but rather his fellow scientists when he suggested that the world was revolving around the sun and not the other way around. So I suspect that politically funded science dictates where the political funds will go for science, and that we want to be cautious of that situation, that there are people on the IPCC itself that disagree, that there are credentialed climatologists like Roy Spencer, that there are websites like IceCap that are putting forth, you know, peer-reviewed scientific data that show contrary indications to what we're talking about in terms of the human causes of carbon. And I'm not suggesting that it's not there, and I'm not suggesting it's not possible, but I'd hate to see us rush into a situation where we respond before we've taken the opportunity to clearly define the causes and not simply the effects. And by the way, I wish you great luck with your peach trees in Vermont. I'm originally from Massachusetts, and I understand.
Thank you. Thank you, Joseph. Obviously, lots there. And I just want to make it clear that the ongoing discussion is very fruitful around climate change. Absolutely. The discussion of, you know, exactly what is the contribution of combusting coal versus, you know, clearing forests in various parts of the world, how those contributions are become drivers of climate change in time. This is all still important stuff to work out. And they And they're very important because it leads into this more regional understanding of climate change. So instead of thinking just continentally, we can actually think regionally, the Midwest, what will happen in the Midwest in the next 30 years. And just as a side point, there's a wonderful new Obama appointee named Jane Lubchenco, who is now heading up NOAA, right, the Atmospheric and Oceanographic Administration. She's a brilliant ecologist, 35 years studying, and what she's doing is putting into place a national climate service. So like the National Weather Service, which is also what NOAA does, we will now have a regional understanding of climate based on these models and based on, as you suggest, rigorous, robust understanding of those drivers of change. That's absolutely really important. Even still,
we have about 15 seconds.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, it's okay. We're out of time. I guess we'll have to stop there.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you so much. You are just wonderful, and you're such a gifted writer. It's a beautiful book.
I have so enjoyed the day. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure, Amy. Amy Seidel, Seidl. The book is highly recommended, Early Spring, An Ecologist and Her Children Wake to a Warming World. It has just been published by Beacon Press and is well worth your time. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to John Treader and Sherry Esser for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for all of your calls. We'll have many more hours of great conversation ahead. I'll be with you again on Monday for All Things Political at 9 o'clock in the morning. And until then, have a great weekend. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.